This is the Sit Down with Olwethu Lishabane, a podcast for women everywhere who are exploring the art of superwoman.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on Art of Superwoman, where you and I explore the art of superwoman. We are always keen to hear what is on your mind, so please do not hesitate to leave your comments, topic suggestions, and thoughts below in the comment section, or take a look at the contact info on our site on www.artofsuperwoman.com. Art of Superwoman is a platform for women everywhere who are exploring the modern day womanhood, the art of superwoman. According to a 2019 statistic released by the South African Depression and Anxiety Group, one in six South Africans suffer from anxiety, depression, or substance use problem. Sadly, this does not include serious conditions such as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. Research also indicates that over 40% of South Africans living with HIV also have a diagnosable mental disorder. A study done by UCT's Department of Psychiatry and Mental Health indicates that in low income and informal settlements surrounding Cape Town, one in three women suffer from postnatal depression. While research from rural KZN shows that 41% of pregnant women are depressed, which is more than three times higher than the prevalence in developed countries. So clearly, South Africa has a very poor standing when it comes to our mental health. As our guest today recently tweeted, mental health matters. Conversations about mental health matter. Educating ourselves about mental health matters. Less stigma and judgment around mental health matters. Speaking out matters. And that's exactly what we're going to do today with our guest, Sade Giliberti. March is known as Human Rights Month in South Africa. Typically, when we talk about human rights, we tend to only focus on violations that occurred during apartheid era, and we gloss over current health rights infrastructures that need urgent attention in our country. This month also happens to be International Women's Month, and at Art of Superwoman, we're celebrating the highlighting women who are on the front lines tirelessly advocating for our human rights. Some of us grew up watching SAFTA award-winning Sade Giliberti on Yo TV. The vivacious TV presenter, actress, and media personality currently resides in London and is using her voice and platforms to advocate for mental health and LGBTQ plus rights, amongst other global issues. Sade, welcome to Art of Superwoman, and thank you so much for joining us for this much needed educational conversation on mental health on this Wellness Wednesday. Okay, first things first, you are in London right now, right? Why would you leave beautiful, sunny South Africa? Cold, dreary, dark, gloomy London. So I think I want to start right there.
A question on many people's lips is exactly that, because we all know that the weather in London and the weather in the UK in general is just not the one. It really isn't. But I'm not here for the weather. I'm here for the opportunities. I'm here for what London specifically as a city can offer many, many people, which is just an opportunity with the rest of the world. Not saying that South Africa can't do that. Of course it can, and it has been doing that, especially in the recent years. But when I left 7 years ago, that was the plan. I was like, do you know what? I just need to go and do something somewhere else for a bit. And I need to see if I can do it. And I need to see what it's like that side for a change. And that was my reasoning. I always knew what the weather was like here. And I knew that I could hack it. It wasn't about the weather.
There's so many other things.
But there's so many other things.
But also psychologically, it must be a different dynamic. How was that transition from South Africa to the UK, like psychologically for you?
It definitely was hard, but I think the one thing I had for me was that I did come here for a year in 2007. So I kind of had an understanding of what life is like in London, what the weather is like, what the people are like to a certain degree. I'm not saying in that year I learned it all, but that helped. So when I came back again, all those years later, I kind of knew what I was getting myself into. I think the hardest part for me was dealing with my mental health around the fact that I'd left a cushy life. Mm-hmm. I'd left a fantastic career. I'd left all my friends. I'd left my family. And this time I'd really left. This wasn't just a quick trip. Do you know what I mean? This was real. I've left now. and trying to navigate a new life in a new city is hard, because you have days where you question everything. You're like, what have I done? And why have I done this? And, you know, things here are hard, or it's not, you know, whatever it may be, you really start to question yourself. And then you have moments where you are. And I was honestly like really, really down, because I just was like, how am I meant to do this without a support structure, like a real support structure, where I don't have my friends, I don't have my family, everyone's far away. And it's easy to pick up your phone and WhatsApp someone and say, this is what I'm going through. And then for that person to go, you've got this, don't worry, push through. But they're not in my position. So they don't know what push through means for me at that moment. And they don't know what you've got this means for me in that moment. All of that stuff helps. But when the weather is gray all the time, it's really hard to find the internal sunshine. It really, really is.
I can imagine. I mean, I love how you said that person doesn't know that moment or what push through means for you in that moment. And I think we're all going through a lot of COVID fatigue at the moment. It's a reality that we have all survived and are currently existing right now in a COVID world. And if my intel is correct, you spent a large portion of the pandemic in London. So what was it like, and how were you able to stay sane and to stay grounded in your reality at such a scary time, away from your family, away from your people, or away from home? What were the tools that you were kind of just using during that time?
I mean, we all know how tough that was, that moment. Wherever you were in the world, that first lockdown hit us all so hard in the chest. None of us could breathe. We were like, what is going on? My saving grace is my partner. My saving grace, honestly, is my partner. Like, so many people went through the motions in their relationships and with their partners during the first lockdown. Either they broke up because they were like, yo, we don't feel one another, you know, or they were forced to move in with one another. Whatever it may have been, a lot of things went down for people's relationships. Mine got tighter. We got closer. We were like, we didn't get sick of one another. We learned so much about one another, and we were just there as a support structure for one another, because we both suffer with depression and mental health. She suffers mainly with anxiety. So we kind of had to like buffer each other out and be there for one another going through the different motions. And knowing that we both almost come from the same place of emotion and mental health, or illness, should I say, it was easier for us to be there for one another and to be there for one another through all of that was the pandemic and the fact that we were both away from our family, because she's also South African. And you know, we tried really hard. You know, in the beginning, we were like, right, this is the time we're going to get our prison bodies. We're going to exercise every single day. I think that lasted about 3 weeks. I don't even think we got to 3 weeks, to be fair. We were like, yeah, yeah. So that didn't work out very well. But then what we did do without fail is we made sure we went outside. And the difference with the UK and South Africa, I think it was almost the same, actually. You guys had a really, really, really intense lockdown. But I think we were all allowed outside for about an hour.
Yeah, well, it was like only for like grocery shopping and essential shopping that we were allowed out.
Okay.
You weren't even allowed out your gate. And if you lived in an apartment, you weren't even allowed out your apartment, or like out your apartment complex.
Wow. Okay. No, that's deep. We were at least allowed out, obviously essential shopping and all of that kind of stuff, but we were allowed out for an hour a day to do exercise. And obviously during this hour, everybody became a runner, including us. We also became runners.
Walkers.
Or walkers, yes. We started off as runners and then we'd walk and then, yeah. So we made sure without fail that we did that 1 hour, without fail. We got outside. It didn't matter how hot or cold. Actually, during that pandemic was the nicest summer I've ever had in the UK, of course. So we made sure we got out. We made sure that we stayed in contact with family. Sometimes it was really hard to speak to family because you hear their hardship and you think, well, it's tough for me here, but it's not as tough. And that doesn't make, it makes me feel a certain way. You kind of like start to think of so many things. We were contemplating how we could get back to South Africa if we wanted to get back to South Africa. And so many things were going through our minds at the same time. But the one thing, honestly, that got us both through was each other.
I mean, we've seen you on shows, or we grew up on shows like Yo TV. We saw you on So You Think You Can Dance. We saw you on Survivor South Africa, to just name a few shows that you've done. Well, we've seen a kind of personality, this bubbly, happy, joyful personality that comes through, the strong persona that comes through on our TV. And, you know, when we talk about mental health, we always have this idea of a look, or surely I should know that this person is struggling with depression, or surely I should know that this person is struggling with mental illness. I almost want you to help me debunk this idea of a mental health look.
There is no look. That's the very first thing that people need to start understanding, is there is no look. Depression does not look a specific way. Mental illness does not look a specific way. I think people, when they think mental illness, they go completely far right, and they go to things like schizophrenia, and they go to things like what we've seen in the movies, where people are, you know, in straitjackets and twitching, you know, or that, you know, that's what people go to when you think of mental health, of mental illness. Yes, that is a factor of it, but it isn't it, you know. Mental illness comes with so many looks, faces, voices. The biggest example is Robin Williams, the late actor who unfortunately took his life. We all loved Robin Williams. We used to watch his movies and die with laughter. We thought this guy was the funniest guy ever. And yet he was grappling with mental illness for many, 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 many years, exactly the same as Jim Carrey, grappling with a mental illness for many, many, many years. But we don't see this because we just see the funny guy on our screen. And that is basically what happens, is depression does not take on a form or choose a person. It doesn't go, yeah, you're the one. Okay. We all have things that we deal with on a daily basis. And it doesn't matter who you are. We all have traumas, whether it be childhood traumas or traumas that we start to deal with as we grow up. We all have things that are layered within us that cause an element of depression or anxiety. For some people, it's in the blood. You know, you'll have generations of people who just suffer with anxiety. And then all of a sudden you do too, because without knowing it as a young child, you're exposed to this anxiety. So you think it's normal. Oh, the way you react to that is normal. So that's how I react. Yeah. And we don't realize these things. And that's why things like therapy and counseling is so important, because we start to unpack so much about ourselves. But depression doesn't choose. It doesn't care how rich you are, how poor you are, what the color of your skin is, where you came from, where you didn't come from, how many parents you have, it does not care. And this is what I would love people to understand about depression, because they will look at people maybe like me or other celebrities or other well-known people and go, but what did they have to be depressed about? They've got all the money in the world. They've got all the cars. They've got all the girls. They've got all the men. They've got all the this. They've got all the that. That's all facade.
Yeah.
That's all materialistic things. That's all stuff that sits in the front. You don't know what's happening behind the curtain, you know, because people will very easily say, and I've seen it on social media, you know, I have nothing and I still wake up in the morning and go do my thing. Why are we comparing?
Yeah.
Why are we comparing your life to my life? Because it isn't about a comparison. The fact that you can get up in the morning and go do your thing, well done. You should be giving yourself a pat on the back every day for doing that, because some people physically cannot do it because they are being pulled down by this darkness that they actually don't know what to do with it anymore.
Yeah.
And it's more about understanding, education, and more so compassion.
Absolutely. And just, you know, also during the pandemic, it's heightened so many of those things because we had to spend so much time sitting with ourselves. So from this, these last, I think we've had like three waves of lockdown, but from your pandemic experience, how has that changed your understanding of self, of the idea of home and the idea of family?
That is such a good question. It made me realize how strong I am as a person. Number one, I've always known how strong I am. Or should I say, in my 20s, I started to learn about how strong I actually am. And it reminded me of how strong I was. It reminded me of my strength and it reminded me of my resilience. And that's what the lockdown, it did for most people. It either showed you your strengths or it showed you your weaknesses. And you had to decide what you were going to do with either one of those things. And in my weakness, I decided to find strength. I was like, nah, I'm not going to be beaten down by this thing. Whatever's happening in the outside world, the whole world is going through it. I am not a victim. This isn't just happening to me. And I think that's what a lot of people possibly realized, that this isn't just me. It's now a global thing.
It's not personal. It's not personal.
It's not personal. And we like to make everything personal, because if it's not about me, then who is it about? Do you know what I mean? We all walk around as if everything is owed to us and it's me, 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 me. But what this pandemic reminded me is it's not me. This isn't about me. And my ego has to be literally pushed aside right now. And actually most of the time, our egos need to be pushed aside, because we are fueled by ego and it's a big, big, big problem. But with regards to like home and that, you know, as much as I missed South Africa and missed my family and missed my friends, what this pandemic reminded me as well was home is where you are. Home is where this is. Home is where you feel safe and okay. And in that moment, it was with my partner in our apartment in London. That was home. And it's a weird one to kind of say out loud, because people go, so your home isn't South Africa anymore. But people need to understand that South Africa will always be my home, always. But I'm making a home elsewhere. And home is where you are. It doesn't have to be a physical place. It doesn't have to be a place where you are now going to go down on your knees and kiss the earth. I'm going to go down on my knees downstairs and kiss the earth. At home, it's home. So that was the big thing for me, was also just realizing that this is home right now. And yeah, I think it was just, it was a big thing about just grappling with being here now, instead of trying to be elsewhere and sort out things or figure things out elsewhere for other people. It was about, there was an element of selfishness. Be here now. What do I need to do right now for me to get through this?
I think it also, you know, I relate so much with that, because I want to take care of everyone. I'm such a mom for everyone. And in that moment, I just had to learn to be so selfish and be, you know, to be so selfless to myself, you know, to come. And it was the hardest, because I was, you know, now I have to start taking care of myself. I have to introspect, I have to search within, I have to heal, I have to do the work. And I've never needed more therapy than during that period. I know how to solve everybody else's problems, except in that moment, I had to now look at how I am this control freak in a lot of situations. But there's also this stigma, right, around mental health. And as a queer biracial South African person who already has to deal with a lot of stigma of just being you, why take on another stigmatized battle? Because you're an activist too within the mental health space. And how does your racial identity, your sexuality and gender factor into the mental health advocacy work that you do? Because people love to categorize, to conclude, to make their own assumptions and to say, you don't have any more, you don't have problems. But now you are choosing this problem.
So let me step back. Let me go all the way back first. Prior to me coming out or anything like that, all I was this biracial girl on TV that everybody saw, bubbly, like you said, fantastic personality, jumping up and down, super crazy, like What are you sad about? Nobody knows what I was dealing with internally. Nobody knows what I was dealing with at home. Nobody knows what my upbringing was like. And to a certain degree, I've been open about it, about certain stuff in my life that had caused the depression, caused the sadness and all of the thoughts and all of the things in my life that I have now learned to deal with in my late 30s. So when I found out truly about the South African Anxiety and Depression Group, for example, and what they do, and when they started sharing statistics with me, I was like, there is no ways I can keep quiet about this. There is no ways, A, I can keep quiet about my own mental health, and there's no ways that I can't, that I, you know, that I could just sit back and do nothing. I have been fortunate enough to be given a platform where hundreds and thousands, if not millions of people are listening to me. And that was the thing in South Africa, especially when I started speaking out about mental health and I started doing work with SADAG. I was like, there is no way that a person like me can keep quiet about this, especially when I heard about the teen suicide rates, especially when I heard about how young kids are that commit suicide in South Africa. I was like, what? As a child star, as a kids presenter, I was still on YoTV at the time. There was like, there is no ways that I can ignore this. There is no way. I can't, you know, I cannot. And obviously growing up in the 90s, as a biracial person, that came with its own struggles. That came with its own things. I mean, listen, kids are mean. Okay.
They are mean.
And we don't realize how mean we are to each other as adults, never mind, but as children, it is another level. So the stuff that I had to deal with as a child going to school, just because of who I was, just because of the fact that my mother was Black and my father was white, that came with its own thing. Do you know what I mean? That was just like, people said the weirdest, meanest, ugliest things to me. You know, there were moments where I loved school and I didn't want to go to school. Or, you know, my mom would be like, they're in the ready, you know, and I'd be like, no, don't be that guy because it's kind of embarrassing, you know. But that was childhood. And then on top of all of that, I am the, you know, the Edgar's catalog kid. And then I'm the Yo TV kid. So now I'm dealing with kids teasing me because of what I do.
All of that.
You know what I mean?
They will humble you.
So I'm being teased because of what I'm doing in my spare time, but also I'm being teased because of who I am, you know. So that added another layer to identity, self-identity. Am I okay with who I am? Do I want to be somebody else? Why is it so much easier for that person and so harder for this person? And why is it so difficult for me? So there is a moment of just trying to figure out your own identity in that moment. Never mind the fact that I was already grappling with my sexuality. Nobody knew. Okay. So there's a lot going on in 10-year-old Sharae's head at the same time. Do you know what I mean? Again, nobody knows this. And then as you get older, like I said, at this point, it's fast forward again. I'm now working with SADAG. I'm still grappling with my sexuality. And for me, it was just, it was always going to be a no-brainer. I remember when I came out to certain people, friends aside, but like, let's go deep, let's go family. It was, well, you're gay because of this. And mm-hmm. you're suffering with depression because of that. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know what I mean? So everyone was a psychologist to me and explained my whole life to me and why I was how I was. And I was just like, listen, guys, everything that you're saying to me is very textbook. And I've even heard it from a psychologist. But no, unfortunately, all wrong. Do you know what I mean? You know, and because like my dad, for example, was like, why would you want to choose this life? Life is tough enough. Why would you want to be gay? And I was like, nobody chooses to be gay. I didn't wake up this morning and go, oh, I want to live that difficult life. That's going to be fun. You know what I mean? Like, life is hard enough as like, a heterosexual person, as a woman.
I sometimes say, like, I wake up every day, I'm like, I choose to still be married to a guy. Like,
Do you know what I mean? Like, honestly, do you know what I mean? So when people have said, like, when my dad said that to me, I was like, listen, this isn't a choice. And this is something that I've been grappling with since I was a little kid. And if I could change, I would change. And trust me, I tried. I tried to date men. And, you know, and I was just like, no.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. You know what I mean? So, so for me, it's always just been a very simple thing.
Mm.
When you know, when I started working with SADAG, when Facebook and all of those things were a thing, I always used to get messages from random people asking me all sorts of questions, whether it was about their sexuality, whether it was about depression, whether it was, it doesn't matter. And I always responded when I had the capacity to do so. I would always respond and I would always say to them, listen, I am not a psychologist. I am not a counselor. You will probably need to seek professional help. This is my point of view for your situation. I always tried to be very objective to what people were saying to me and kind of respond to them for their situation. And, you know, 95% of the time people would come back to me and go, oh my gosh, the advice that you gave me, it did wonders. Thank you so much. I'm now seeing a psychologist. I'm now this. I came out to my parents. This is what happened. This is the... So I always said to myself, if I help one person, just one, that's enough. All I need to do is help one person. And I'm hoping to God that that person will pay it forward and help another person. And that's been my thing. I've got a platform. I need to use it in a positive manner. I need to educate people. I need to re-educate people. And I need people to understand and come to see life, see depression, see subjects, see things with compassion and with understanding, and instead of their narrow-minded, one-sided way. And if I'm not going to do it, there's going to be somebody else, and that's fine. It's not a, I need to do it first. It's a, why was I given this platform?
And just on that note, I mean, we've seen how social media has, you know, mental health is and has become a buzzword on social media. Let's just like be straight up with it. But the reality is social media does not represent the greater South Africa. There are so many people that are not represented on social media. People are living with an extreme amount of internal pain and internal hate. Other than having informative conversations like we're having now, what else can we actively do in our everyday life to not only to stigmatize mental health, but also to begin the work of actually healing people? What is the groundwork that we need to be doing? Because if we are,
I think, you know,
and we don't start doing the work, it's going to continue killing us. And like we said earlier on, this is, some of these things are passed on through generational hurts, through generational anxiety, through generational pain.
Yes. I think the very first thing is we all, as individuals, need to go internally, which is the hardest thing for any single human to do. We hate, what? I must do work for me. I don't have time for this. I've got to clean the house. I've got to do washing. I've got to feed the kids. I don't have time to sit down and go internal. And also going internal means dealing. And so many people do not want to deal. They don't want to go deeper. They don't want to unpack and they don't want to deal. If we all individually did that, it doesn't matter how cushy you think your life is on the outside. We all have trauma. We all do. Some trauma is layered and thick and deep and goes back 100 years, and some trauma is from last week. And that's fine, but we need to deal and we need to understand the trauma, understand the triggers of the trauma, and then heal the trauma. Have conversations. Do you know what I mean? So many of us are so afraid to have conversations with our elders because we're like, no, it's disrespectful. I can't ask those questions. How are you meant to heal generational trauma if you don't do that? How are you meant to heal generational trauma if you don't have the conversation with Ugogo and ask her, okay, Gogs, talk me through this. What happened? Blah, blah, blah. Why do you feel such a way about this certain type of person? Why are you so angry about this? Because now I'm automatically angry and I don't even understand why. Do you know what I mean? And if we don't have those conversations, we can't internally heal. The only way that we can understand depression, understand anxiety, understand mental illness as a whole, is for us to do the internal work, for us to do the homework, for us to heal. Once we've done that, then we can look at another person with love because we've now done the work for self. Mm-hmm. We're now feeling the self-love and the self-compassion and all the work for self. Then we can look at another person with love. Then we can look at another person with understanding. Then we can look at another person with compassion. When we can do all of those things, we can destigmatize what we all think mental health looks like and is, because now we understand, oh, wait, this has nothing to do with what I thought it did. Mm-hmm. This is not a thing that only hits poor people. This is not a thing that only hits Black men. This is not a thing that only hits women. This can happen to anybody at any time. At any time, for any reason, it does not matter. If you don't deal with it, think, listen, if you hurt your leg badly and you let the wound and you leave the wound, it's going to get worse. It's going to get infected. You're probably going to have gangrene. And at some point, you're going to have to lose the leg. It's the same with anything that happens in our lives. If we ignore, it builds. And we continue to ignore, and then it builds. And then it manifests itself in a horrible and ugly way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
External is exactly the same as internal. And a lot of people don't realize that. A lot of people do not have the patience to do the internal work because they want the work to be done like this. And but that's not how it works. It's like not how it works.
Like you mentioned earlier on, I think we want to so much personalize somebody else's pain before we personalize our own.
Yes.
So we almost want to understand why Sade is struggling with her mental illness and her mental health before I understand that it's all of our work. We all have the work to do.
Yes.
Or I can understand, I need to almost understand myself. And in understanding myself, I'm in a better place to not place any judgment, but to also hold space when you share.
100%, exactly what you just said there. And I'm going to go back to what you mentioned earlier on. And I'm exactly the same. It's so easy to help others, to give advice to others, to sit back and listen and go, okay, let me look at your situation and let me help you. But then what about self? Mm-hmm. The hardest part is to sit down and to do that for self. You had to learn that during lockdown. Whoa, I've got a lot of self-healing to do. Mm-hmm. I've got a lot of introspective things to do right now. I need to do me now. And a lot of people don't want to do me. And that is important because, like you said, once you've done me, you can hold space. That is literally it. We need to hold space for one another. And we don't do that. My problem with social media, for example, is we have trigger happy thumb warriors.
Yeah.
People who hide behind avatars. People who are very quick to respond, knee-jerk reactions to whatever it is people are saying on social media. Yes, some things are ridiculous and some things aren't. Some are a cry for help and some are just plain old attention seeking. It doesn't matter which way you see it. Mm. I always just think to myself, people on social media need to stop with the knee-jerk reaction and need to stop reacting with their heads. And I always say to people, don't respond or comment if you have nothing good to say. If that person's status upset you or made you think, then you know what? Don't respond. Because we never know what that person is going through.
Yeah.
Why that person put that status up there. If it was attention seeking, fine. If it was a cry for help, we don't know. But then you're going to come with your negativity. You're going to come with your thing. You're going to come with your thing. You're going to come with your thing. And then the next day when something happens, everyone's like, so shook.
Yeah.
And then there's broken hearts and doves and now we're sorry. But what did you say the day before?
Mm.
That is my biggest problem with social media.
Mm.
That is honestly like it is a fantastic tool when it needs to be, because then it reaches people and messages are shared, but it's the trigger happy warriors on the other end who know nothing about somebody else's life. And I always say, and I've said it since day dot, even when I used to go to schools, our parents taught us this: say nothing if you have nothing good to say. You have no idea what people are going through.
Absolutely. One of the studies coming out of SADAG is that South Africans suffer from anxiety, depression, or substance use problems. 40% of South Africans living with HIV also have a diagnosable mental disorder. 1 in 3 women suffer from postnatal depression. I'm one of them. And research from rural KZN shows that 41% of pregnant women are depressed, and that doesn't even factor in the youth and children. Inherited traumas, or the impact of COVID. Who needs to be leading the charge? And what role should our government be playing on a national and local level in order to meet or to almost come up with solutions around society's desperate need for mental healing?
So this is, I mean, those statistics are harrowing and they're real. And they are, I mean, you know, I sit back now, I'm just going to digress for a very short moment. I sit back now and I realize that, you know, I went through a lot of ish with my mom, a rural woman from KZN. And as an adult and unpacking my depression and unpacking my issues, I realized that she herself was depressed.
Yeah.
And she didn't know how to deal with her own depression. And that's what I realized. So, you know, you hearing what you just said right now, I was like, yes. And a lot of people don't know that they're depressed. A lot of people don't understand that they're going through a thing, and they will just layer it up with other things and carry on with life as if everything's okay. But then we'll snap one day, or we'll have moments where they snap.
Yeah.
So, but to answer your question, I think, you know, the government needs to be working very closely with organizations like SADAG and other organizations out there. They need to be working very closely with clinical psychologists. They need to be working very closely with people who are doing this research. And I don't think they are doing enough. And I don't think they are working with the right people. I also don't think we have the right people in government standing in front of people, speaking to them about all of these things. We need people that we can trust. And we need people that know what they are talking about. Hence me saying, work closely with the organizations and work closely with the doctors. And if you have to create a whole new thing of just clinical psychologists and counselors and, you know, basically a second SADAG or a bigger SADAG, do that, you know. I feel the government doesn't help the South African Anxiety Group enough because, you know, they're an organization that have been around for many, many years and they still struggle as an organization. And I think that's ridiculous. They should be so massive, so huge, have the capacity to help way more people than they already do. And I think, you know, it all starts from home. It all starts from home. If we had leaders who are honest enough to say, you know what, I have moments, or I've had moments, or this is what happens with me, or I'm on antidepressants, and this is what I do, you start to break it down a little bit more. We start to lose that stigma. It's the fact that everyone is put on a pedestal. And when they all come out with their depressive stories or with their mental illness, that it's like, no.
Because they fall from grace.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think that it needs to be a case of more people need to come together. We are seeing a lot of, you know, well-known people, a lot of media personalities, especially in the recent weeks, speaking out and trying really hard to, you know, educate people about different apps or doctors or free counseling places that they can go to. But it's not enough. And it is not up to solely us individuals who have platforms. The government really need to step up, and the government really need to, they need to care. You know, what's hard about a place like South Africa with our 11 tribes is we have, there's an African ideology. And there is, the truth is most of our tribes don't have a word for depression. Mm. It doesn't exist. So how are you going to educate a rural gogo on depression when you can't actually even explain, there's no word to explain it to her. The only word is crazy.
Or in Xhosa we say, hey, perezinebs.
You see. Do you know what I mean? And even then, you know, do you know what I mean? You know, so we need to be able to break that down. And I'm not saying create a word, but find a way to educate, especially people in the rural areas, and especially people who don't have access to day-to-day education, to libraries, to whatever it may be, and say, this is a thing. And this is what happens to people. And it can be generational. And you probably have are suffering from something. Why can't we have more pop-up counseling sessions, you know, kind of like, what's the word I'm thinking of right now? I've absolutely gone blank. Like social.
In communities, communities come together. Yes.
There we go. Communities who come together and go, do you know what? On Saturday, we're going to have 3 hours of this. This doctor's going to be there. That doctor's going to get the local doctors from the area. Get the local doctors from the hospitals in the area. Go, this is what we're going to do every second Saturday. This is what we're going to come to your community. I'm going to teach you about this. We're going to talk to you about that. We're also going to have open counseling sessions. We're going to, do you know what I mean? That's what we need to be doing. We need to, that's the only way we're going to break down the stigma, but the government needs to help us, because it doesn't help when presidents and ministers sit there and go, oh, you know, we're having this epidemic at the moment. Gender-based violence is a thing. Suicide has gone up. Yeah, but what are you doing about it? Mm-hmm. What are you doing about it? Because we can all speak.
I'm curious about how the UK public health system addresses mental health issues, because here in South Africa, the stats say that 16% of people dealing with mental health issues receives treatment, even though 85% of these patients are dependent on public health services. There are only 18 beds per 100,000 people available in such hospitals. And only 1% of these are reserved for children and adolescents. So how does the UK public health system address some of these mental health issues? What can we learn from maybe other parts of the world and learn and implement from existing structures on dealing with the scourge of our mental health issues?
So I think, you know, this country, with regards to their public health system and the NHS, the National Health System, as they call it here, they do take mental health very seriously. But being a public public system, a public healthcare system, for certain things, there is always a little bit of a waiting list. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to just phone them up and say, listen, I need to see a psychologist. And they go, cool, come tomorrow. It may be a 3-week wait. It may be a 1-month wait. But what they will do is they will get you in to see someone immediately. So you will get in to see a GP who will, you know, analyze you. They're not very quick on giving out antidepressants. They're not going to just go, okay, cool, yeah, antidepressants, let's go. They're going to be like, right, maybe we should go to CBT, or maybe we should do this, or maybe we should do that. There is about a 2-week wait. Can you? Do you know what I mean? It's all about having the conversations with the person. I don't know what it's like with regards to beds and if somebody has to be admitted, if they're having like severe psychological, breakdowns. I've not personally looked into that. But the one thing that the UK does have, which I think is one up on South Africa, because South Africa, I think there are smaller organizations, but they solely rely on SADAG. Here, there are many organizations, many, many, many. So if you cannot get in with the public health system, there are so many organizations that are available at a drop of a text, a drop of a call, and you have somebody to speak to any day, anytime. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is very, very helpful, that it's not just one sole organization who's taking on the brunt of the whole nation. We have many, there are so many, and the best part is there are also many that deal with just LGBTQ plus people, which also is very helpful, because then you'll have volunteers or counselors who are LGBT, so they know how to deal with that person on the other side of the line. Either they've had similar situations or they've encountered similar situations. So when you're getting help from somebody who's been there, done that, as opposed to, I don't really understand, but I'm going to be a hearing, you know, which is fine as well. It doesn't matter. Sometimes you don't need to understand. Sometimes you just need to be a person who will listen, and a person who will try and calm the other person down and kind of give them, you know, ways and avenues to go, right, this is the best way to deal with it. So I think where they want up here is just the amount of charity organizations that are available to the people on the daily basis. And I mean really available. Obviously, if we go into the rurals, it gets a little bit more scarce. you know, middle England and all of that, it gets a little bit more scarce. So it's obviously the biggest cities have everything, but still all of these places are a phone call away, you know. It doesn't mean that just because you live in rural middle England that you can't call somebody. You still can. But with regards to the charity physically being down the road from you, that is still difficult. But, you know, the people have become very much aware of the importance of mental health awareness in this country. And you have all the way up to the royals, you know, Prince William and Prince Harry are very passionate about mental health awareness and all of that. So they do a lot of work for it. So when you have people like that who are very much aware that this is a problem, and the suicide rate is high in this country. The suicide rate is white men mainly.
Yes,
obviously it's a very white island, but it's mainly men than anything else, you know. And the fact that people are aware that it's an issue from such a high level is important, because it trickles down, and that's why the government in South Africa needs to do more. Because if people at the top recognize the issue, then it can start to trickle down properly. We can start to attack and fix and heal our nation on a level that has never, ever been done. I mean, if we have to think realistically about South Africa, what, we've been a democracy for under 30 years. When we're so young. We're a young adult. We are a young adult. Our trauma isn't that far back. Our trauma is really not that far back. So we've got a lot of healing to do just as a nation, never mind individually.
Sure. And for those who may not or cannot afford to see a therapist or don't have the resources, where can they find free resources or access free resources? What would you recommend?
I will always shout out the SADAG. I will always shout them out. You know, I'm a huge fan of the work that they do. And, you know, they're available on WhatsApp. They're available on Facebook. They're available on every single social media platform you can think of. They've got an SMS line. They've got a hotline. They've got a toll free. They've got all the lines available to you. And I always, you know, I think you can even, I don't even know if it's a thing, but back in the day, you could send please call me's and they could phone you back. Please call me's a thing.
I think they are still a thing.
Oh, are they?
I haven't used one in a while, but I do think they're still a thing.
Okay. But so basically you could do that as well. You could send a please call me to SADAG and they will phone you back, you know. So I think people need to seek out those kind of organizations. I'm sure now in 2022, SADAG isn't the only one. They're probably still the biggest and prevalent one, but I'm sure there are maybe smaller ones coming up here and there. We're also living in an age where almost every single person has a smartphone. It doesn't matter where you are in the world. You know, everyone has a smartphone, whether it's a 500 Rand smartphone or a 10,000 Rand smartphone, everyone has one, which means you have access to apps and stuff like that. There are also apps that exist that people can look for and find that help you, where you can speak to professionals, where you can access just daily help. People need to also look into their communities. If nothing exists, how can we create it? How can we create for the community that someone is here, that some people are here, that people volunteer? I think if there isn't anything, we need to create it. Yeah. If it doesn't exist, we need to make sure that it does exist.
Yeah. What age did you become aware of the concept of mental health? And what do you think you needed most at that point in time?
I think when I fully, I mean, I, gosh, it's so warped when I tell people, because it's very easy for me to go, oh, when I was a teenager, but that's not the truth. I was much younger. I wasn't even a teen yet when I knew that things were a hit and miss, that I was feeling a certain way, that I was depressed. I must have been about 8 or 9 years old, which is really, really young. But also at the same time, if you look at the statistics in South Africa, it's not, because no, it's 8 and 9 year olds
because now
are killing themselves.
I almost want to ask, like, when should we start educating our children about mental health? And what are the needs that they have at that age? What are their mental health needs? Because we're not thinking about mental health on a overall wellness level, I think, enough. We almost leave it to, I almost draw a parallel with it with the liver. Nobody quite processes how important the liver is in their body until it's too late. Because the liver can function on 20% functionality and still run your body for you. So, are we going to wait for that to happen in our nation where we're functioning on 20% for us to realize how integral this thing is to our overall wellness? How young is too young?
So that is the question right there. A lot of people believe it's too young. No, you can't speak to kids about LGBT. You can't speak to kids about mental health. You can't. They're young. You're now creating the problem. You're instilling the problem. You're teaching them the problem. And I personally do not believe that. I believe that we need to be as open as possible with these little human beings from as early as they can speak. Because young children, babies, toddlers, they are human beings. They are taking in, they are retaining information constantly all the time. So if they are surrounded by intensity, lots of fighting, a depressed parent, what do you think is going to happen to this child? Naturally, so they're going to absorb all of that and grow into such person of having to deal with, you know, their own thing or thinking that that is normal or whatever it may be. So the minute a child knows to put a square peg in the square.
Yeah.
When they're doing square peg into a circle and you go, no, put it in the square, and they realize, oh, that's where it goes. That's when you start speaking to them.
Yeah.
You need to speak openly and you need to speak honestly with these little human beings. And we need to stop treating children. I'm not saying treat them as adults and be like, right, now you're a man at the age of 3. No, I'm not saying that. But open and honest conversations with these little human beings will do such wonders, because from a young age, you are instilling so much in them that they comprehend, that they grasp. There's obviously means and ways of doing it. And we just have to find the gentlest ways of doing it. But it's exactly the same as, like, you know, people get upset with, like, you get these like esoterical schools where they just allow children to be, as opposed to like teaching them a curriculum of science, which I don't completely disagree with, because you have to allow the child to figure out what they like and what they don't like and who they want to be. And they do that naturally. Children are not only here for us to teach them, but they teach us.
Yeah.
And adults don't like that. What do you mean a child must teach me? Children must sit in the corner and keep quiet. Do you know what I mean? So that, all of that comes into education as well, of how we need to uneducate ourselves from everything, unlearn everything that we know, so that we can relearn a new way of creating better, happier, loving human beings. We have to unlearn so much. And I think we have to stop being afraid of speaking to little human beings from a young age about everything.
Yeah, absolutely. When all is said and done, what do you want to be remembered about when it comes to your work and your advocacy work?
That I tried. That I stood on a soapbox or on social media or on television or in the papers or in a blog and tried to make a difference.
I truly appreciate the conversation. This was absolutely amazing, eye-opening, and I really think so many young people are really going to just take so much from this and, you know, get active in taking care of their mental health and taking action towards their mental health.
You've been listening to The Sit Down with Olwethu Lishabane, a podcast for women everywhere who are exploring the art of superwoman.